CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from the very top of Burnaby Mountain.
We're stoked to be your host for the next hour, exploring local and global events using sociological perspectives. Thanks for tuning in.
Hello, my name is Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
Welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM. We are broadcasting on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, also known as Burnaby Mountain, at Simon Fraser University. Thanks for joining us tonight. We're happy to have you here. We've got another great day of theory deep dive for you. As you may have heard, if you've been catching up with us, we have been doing these theory deep dives throughout where we really focus on the sociological aspect of our sociologics show.
Yes.
Today's topic that we're coming at you with is we're going to be centering around Emile Durkheim. A little bit about Emile Durkheim is he is a French sociologist. He talks a lot. He's known for his work on fundamentalism and his talks about social relations, etc., etc. So we'll be talking a little bit about him today, bringing in our thoughts, connecting it to some real life examples, so you guys know a little bit more about him. And why he's important to the discipline.
And he's often called the father of sociology. Just putting it out there. Like, he is one of the main dudes alongside Marx and Weber.
Yeah.
But he is one of the main ones.
So, timeline we're thinking of is we're thinking France, 1858 is when he was born. He did a really good job of establishing sociology as a discipline, which is where that whole father thing came from. And like many of the social sciences, a lot of the things we're taught is about how the great white men really led the charge. And he is one of those white men that we are taught about, but he does have some good stuff to say.
And he's really relevant. If you're trying to understand sociology from its foundations and fundamentals, you do have to take a look at this old white man.
For sure.
Yep.
So, Rebecca, let's start us out. What do you know about Durkheim? Because in our preparation for this episode, we really realized how different our education on him.
Yeah, so I feel like for me, I was introduced to Durkheim when it was the start of my A-level sociology course, and we started to delve into the topics of identities and inequalities, which is in like our paper one of the exam. And in the inequality section, you get introduced to the main theoretical concepts, which is Marxism, functionalism, neo-Marxism, feminism, and then like some others come into it, like New Right, postmodernism, and a couple more.
All of the isms, really.
Yeah, all of the isms come out. But the first one we sort of come to terms with is functionalism, and Durkheim is known as one of the key kind of foundational, I guess, not creators of functionalism, but he's one of the like fundamental people that created the foundations of functionalism as a structural consensus theory, which means that functionalists think that there is a social structure that shapes an individual's behavior through the process of socialization, which we've spoken about.
Is functionalism the one that they compare to the body?
Yeah, it's related biologically.
Like, there's all of the little organs that are all working together,
yeah.
And so there's all of these systems in society that are working together.
Yeah.
For an example of where like how functionalism could be implemented is functionalists don't necessarily think crime is bad. And there's a lot of critique about functionalism because it can be used to defend other more negative social structures. But why they wouldn't think crime is bad is because once those people are caught and then are given judgment and punishment, that is then creating a precedent showing for people to not do crime, there need to be people who do crime and get punished.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
And I think also they operate on a system that a successful society is based on a valued consensus, which is like your shared set of norms and values that's you agree as a society is like how you achieve, how you work together to achieve those goals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in my understanding of functionalism, they view inequalities not as a product of capitalist society, but as like a necessity for society to successfully function.
For sure.
Right? So it's kind of, is like the polar opposite to Marxism.
Yeah.
Where it's like talking more about how inequalities are a product of a capitalist society and your bourgeoisies and top elite and stuff. So that's kind of where Durkheim comes into it for me. He was just like the main sociologist for functionalism when we were looking at identities and inequalities,
mm-hmm.
and looking at socialization, because he heavily focuses on like socialization through his division of like labor theory and social solidarity, which I'm sure we'll go into. And he has like some key concepts which we brought, which other sociologists kind of developed on in like the 1950s when it came to socialization,
mm-hmm.
Particularly relating it to youth.
Interesting. See, we probably learned about him in my intro year, but not in a way that I super stood out to me. We learned about functionalism, yes, but I don't know if I necessarily caught that that was his. I think that I just got shocked by something.
The perks of Studio B.
So in my sociological theory classes, where we really dived into his work, we were reading the Elementary Forms of Religious Life, which is his last work, published in 1912, right before he died. This man really took it to the grave. He was working hard. I think he died in maybe 1915 or 14 or 15 or something, like just a few years after that. But the argument of this piece is more around the community, which I feel like could connect to some of his past, but it's also a strong critique of capitalism and how capitalism is very isolating. And in this final piece, he talks mainly through the social structure of religion as a method of breaching those social divides and reunifying people as a way to help the general public to fight against that isolation. And so that is kind of where I'm coming from with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to hear all of your stuff. And
yeah.
So a lot of these very early sociological writers, they were writing so much, like so much, just in and out.
It's interesting to me because I haven't touched on Durkheim really as solely just touching like upon him and his work. Mm-hmm. Since A-level, like, my degree doesn't really focus on Durkheim. We focus more and more, like, they're heavily focused on recent research. Like, they want to see what's up to date, right? So I've actually never read any of Durkheim's work because we touched upon him as, like, a cog in functionalism overall.
For sure.
So we were looking way more at the overarching theory and what theorists were in that.
Yeah.
So I'm very new to, like, what he actually spoke about in his actual published work and stuff. Also because religion wasn't a topic on my curriculum.
Interesting.
So because I never really touched upon religion at all. It was like in the background of some things, but that was about it.
Yeah. So the class that I took that was with us is Lindsay Freeman's Sociology Anthropology 250. It's the Introduction to Sociological Theory, which is required for our major. So that is where I believe we just read an excerpt from the Elementary Forms of Religious Life, but I cannot actually remember. I think we might have read one more piece by him. So I'm not fully familiar with all of his work, just his much later work right before he died. But I think the reason that we were so focused on it is because it was a theory class, and
he is a main theorist.
He is one of the main theorists.
He's one of the
definitely
main
one
ones.
Because we kind of worked our way, like, Max Weber, who's one of the German ones, Karl Marx, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Did you do Foucault?
We didn't in that class, but we've talked about him in other classes. Yeah, Michel Foucault. Actually, we might have. I can't remember.
I feel like Foucault's become a big one in, like, English curriculum as, like, one of the main sociologists.
Yeah.
But it's more of a recent one, though.
Panopticon, right?
I have no idea what Panopticon is.
This is a little... here, I'll do my quick make sure that I have this all right. But we'll play you a song really quick before we continue diving in. This is... what are we going to start with? This is The Girl by City in Color. This song gives me tingles when I listen to it. It's just so beautiful and I think very budding love romantic. And City in Color is, I found out, a Canadian artist, which is awesome.
Oh, nice.
And I love them so much. So here you go.
Chasing my own dreams, sailing around the world. Please know that I'm yours to keep, my beautiful girl.
And we're back. Welcome back to Sociologic. We are today doing a theory deep dive, talking about Emile Durkheim. Thanks for joining us today. So we were just talking about how our schools took a very different approach to what of Durkheim's work has been shared with us. And also that little extra sociological tidbit that I was going to tell you about Foucault. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure that I was accurate. So if you do go to Simon Fraser University, this will be particularly relevant to you. So Panopticon is this... Michel Foucault talks about it in terms of a prison where if it's all in a circle and all of the windows face each other, it's this idea of collective control where essentially nobody's going to disbehave because there's the idea that somebody could be watching them. And so at any given time, somebody could be watching them and then therefore they're not going to like act out and stuff. But it's interesting when you kind of look at a lot of the ways that SFU things are organized in terms of the sub having a lot of glass walls and windows looking mm-hmm. into the different study rooms, or even the academic quadrangle, or if you've been to the SFU Surrey campus where all of the window, we talked about this in my intro to sociology class about the Panopticon, but that's just an interesting one where it's just as a form of social control. But that mm-hmm. that was a bit of a tangent.
A bit of a tangent, which we are so guilty for doing on this show. But I think it's what makes our show ours, you know?
Yeah, right? When you follow our little brain babies. So I can kind of take us into some of the stuff that I know from Durkheim's... Mm-hmm. So this paper, the... Elementary Forms of Religious Life, is essentially him breaking down the different aspects of the collective. He references this. He says in a way that you might, I don't know, this aged peculiarly, but you can pull from it a lot. Basically, he says you need to boil it down to its roots. And so he compares it to this religion called totemism. Where he went to the most elementary form of religious life. That probably wouldn't fly now, seeing as he mm-hmm. was just then studying an indigenous religious practice and calling it, like, less.
Yeah.
Or calling it elementary. Mm-hmm. However, what he gleaned from it is very applicable, I would say. He talked a lot about collective representation. So this mm-hmm. is the idea that you have some form of symbol that... you're able to stand with that will kind of show that you're part of this group. So an example of this is the cross, right?
Mm-hmm.
That for Christianity, right? Like you see a cross, you're like, oh, it's Christianity, right? Or that's a very textbook one, but
like flags.
Yeah,
flags for like countries
are a good one. But also more niche things, too. I did what I'm working off of because I left some of my notes at home is I have this essay from last term from this class, and I was talking about the Taylor Swift fan base, about how 13, I don't know, if you're a Swiftie, 13 is a really important number. So seeing...
See, why... Like, I'm sorry, I don't understand the 13 and, like, 13, Swift.
Here, let me quote Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Because
I know Swifties, but I didn't realize 13. It was only recently I've heard 13 is, like, a big thing.
So, she was born on the 13th, she turned 13. This is a quote from Taylor Swift, by the
right.
way, and that I used in my essay, that I got an A on. Woo-woo! Or maybe an A minus. I don't know. A good grade. I turned 13 on Friday the 13th. My first album went gold in 13 weeks. My number one song had a 13-second intro. Every time I've won an award, I've either been sat in the 13th seat, the 13th row, the 13th section, or row M, which is the 13th number. Basically, I think it's her lucky number, and so it's just, and then the Swifties fan
now,
base is very
Swifties
latches
number.
On very quick to things, and then therefore,
I would have thought it would be 22. Can't lie.
Yeah, that was, so I graduated in the year 2022, and it was so great. We had such a good anthem. We'd play at everything. It was awesome. But yeah, so that collective representation is a really important one because it allows people to brand themselves as part of a group, which Durkheim feels is important in that very isolated world that he's describing, mm-hmm. which he's existing in, like, around the Industrial Revolution, where people are working hard, capitalism's really in full fledged, or, like, just, like, post-Industrial Revolution, but capitalism's in full-fledged, people are working, mm-hmm. it's hard to make time for yourself in groups. But then this next aspect that he talks about that's imperative for the... All of these are also very interconnected, as we know. The next part is the separation between the sacred and the profane. So sacred, pretty straightforward. We're thinking like gods, deities, etc. Something yeah. that is lifted above everybody else and worshipped because of it. The ideals that represents is worshipped. So that's an important part, is that there's an ideal that people are aspiring to, and that is why it's being lifted up above. And then the rest is the profane. And it's important that there's this big separation, a binary separation. So profane in this case is not bad, as like profane language that has a very negative connotation. Profane in this case is just anything that is not sacred. It's us, it's you and me, it's mm-hmm. real, it's down to earth, it's not being worshipped, you know?
Yeah.
And so what he says about that is that it's then able to connect people, because through this shared worship, right? I don't know if you've ever... I mean, if you believe in something and somebody else believes mm-hmm. in you, you're going to feel connected over that, right? Because of that shared idea and shared belief. And you can kind of then add this into motivation theory about... Or the theory of motivation, where there's autonomy, belonging, and competence. Mm-hmm. And if you're ever going to feel motivated to do something, you have to have some combination of those three. So autonomy is the ability to choose whether or not you're doing the thing you need to feel motivated at. Belonging is that you feel like you have, that you belong there, that you should be doing it. And then competence is that you feel you're good at it. And so that... all of those really, like, seep into this as well. You can cross-reference this. And then I'd say the most important thing for me that I learned from this, this was one of those classes where we were learning about him, and I left that class, I was just, like, on my academic high, where I don't know if this has ever happened to you all, but I sometimes I'll go to a class and I'll just leave the class and my brain is reeling. I'm like, wow, this is the most cool thing ever. I'm so glad that I get to learn. I'm so grateful for this opportunity. And I'm just, like, thinking about it for the next handful of hours. Mm-hmm. It's really awesome. But it's the idea of collective effervescence. And you guys might not know this term, but you've probably felt it. Have you heard of collective
effervescence? I have not heard of collective effervescence.
Okay. So,
effervescence. Effervescence.
Which is a beautiful word.
It is.
Really a great, like, mermaid name.
Mm-hmm. It feels very mystical.
So... Durkheim claims this is the best weapon against the alienation caused by capitalism. A quote from him is, the collective effervescence can be felt when the vital energies are over, excited, passions are more active, sensations are stronger, which are all as a result, or that was end quote, as a result of being in a group of people who are all working towards the same goal, or sharing the same, worshiping the same idea, or sharing a collective experience. So I'd say some of the places that I've felt this the strongest are at concerts. Mm-hmm. Concerts where you're all singing the same songs, you're all dancing, you're all there for the same reason and all have come together. I don't know if you've ever felt that feeling of just, like, wow, like, I'm part of this group. Or protests are a good one. Also, I've spent a little bit of time in religious institutions, and I've felt it there as well. Specifically for me, in terms of song, I feel like music is a very easy mm-hmm. way when people are all singing together. Or, like, summer camps, when we're all singing together. One of the activities we did in class was where everybody had to go around and say something. So some examples were graduations, weddings, concerts, etc., etc. But also things like funerals, where you're all there. They don't always have to be positive things. You can all be there for the similar cause. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think, one, I never experienced camps. That's not a thing in England, so I can't relate to it on that level. But I think... I've like never really been to like concerts as much. I've been to one concert, but I would say I mostly feel that in a nightclub scenario.
Yeah, for sure.
That's probably like definitely high up there. But also, I went to two of my closest friends got baptized last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to their baptism, and it was just so emotionally like. Not draining, but like it brought my emotions out to me way more than I thought it ever could, right? Mm-hmm. And their church was like very big on like song and stuff, and then they all had to go around and say why they were getting baptized, why they were choosing to do it now in their lives and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think they were very welcoming, even if you were not religious, even if you took part in no religious practices or mm-hmm. anything, they were so welcoming to you. Like, to be there to support for in whatever capacity you wanted to. And that, like, collective nature, I feel like, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
In terms of the only thing that I would draw back from it in nightclubs is because you're all inebriated with alcohol, pretty much. That it's kind of...
Yeah.
Not necessarily that you're there for the same reason.
Yeah.
I feel like you can still get it there, but I feel like I probably felt it more sober.
Yeah, for than sure. I did, I think that drunk. Shared goal is super important. And...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the big part is it's a visceral experience. It's not something you can experience in other ways. And I really appreciate that part of it because I don't know, I kind of get into my whole, it's part of the human experience, and the human experience is to be feeling things and feeling the things. And so I think just walking away from this class with this idea was super impactful for me because I just really it resonated with me a lot because I was able to put a word to this experience that I've had and that I've been seeking out. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And so his whole spiel on this is that the best way to solve that loneliness is to experience collective effervescence.
Right. See, I can kind of see, like, as you were talking, where my education on Durkheim has fitted in, but you've done it, you've learned it in the framework of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not learn it in a framework of religion because mm-hmm. the religion wasn't on the curriculum for us. And I feel like you focused on his solutions to the feeling of anomie. Mm-hmm. And we learned not the solutions of it, but why anomie exists, what mm-hmm. it means as a concept, which I'll explain. And other kind of like why society is structured the way it is in terms of what functionalism explains it to be, right?
For sure.
And so for those of you who don't know what anomie is, the best way I can like describe it is it's a state of like isolation that's resulted from the breakdown of the social system and social structures. So like your shared norms and values have been broken down, and it mm-hmm. alienates people away because they don't have the guidelines and the norms to be socialized into, right?
For sure.
And it's used a lot in explaining the reasons that we have youth as a transition period mm-hmm. from childhood mm-hmm. to adulthood to avoid the risk of anomie.
Yeah.
It's also used in a way of describing deviancy.
Mm-hmm.
And why people go towards crime.
For sure.
Through functionalism. I think anomie is actually kind of used. I feel like now it's kind of seen as like it's more of an excuse than an explanation.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
In terms of like theories, because obviously, Durkheim was the first person to introduce the concept of anomie, and that's like back in like what we're saying the time period is like late 1800s.
For sure.
So I feel like it's kind of changed a lot since then. But like the way we learned about him was him viewing, obviously we related functionalism to like people looking at, functionists look at society as like anatomical, like mm-hmm. a body, and it's different components working so the body can function, right?
Yeah.
So Durkheim said that he viewed society as an organism